Good afternoon. Thank you for being here and for taking this hour to learn and grow and explore with me. My name is Margie Quinn, and I am your village barista. For 4/5 of the week and for 1/5 of the week, I am on teaching staff coordination. And this week, I actually get to coordinate a spot for me to do some teaching, which has been a really cool opportunity. So thank you for being here. So this session for the recording is called In Search of Sacred Spaces, a Modern Day Pilgrimage. And I'm going to be talking for about 35 to 40 minutes, but I really encourage you, if any questions, thoughts, musings come up as I'm talking, please raise your hand. I would love to have it be kind of a flowing discussion instead of me talking at you for that amount of time. So as soon as you feel like, oh, I really want to know this now, feel free to ask away. And if you have just asked a question or shared a thought, if you would wait maybe 1, 2, 3 people before you are the speaker, again, that way we get some variety in the room and multiple voices sharing input. So, before I came to Holden, yes, there was a time before Holden, I left Seattle in October after living there for 2.5 years and embarked on a 4-month social justice, soul-seeking pilgrimage, which I actually began calling Pilgrimarge quickly into the trip. So the hashtag was Pilgrimarge, and those who were in the experience with me know it as the Pilgrimarge. So we're going to start calling it the Pilgrimarge right now. What is a Pilgrimarge? A Pilgrimarge is a 4-month road trip around the USA with one day passing through Canada, so it did go international. It was also a chance for me to cross off all of these things that I had written on my bucket list, including finding sacred places around the country. It was a chance for me to reconnect with old friends of mine who I hadn't seen because I'd been living in Seattle, and also family members who lived in all kinds of places in the country. And I applied for a grant through a great organization out of Atlanta called the Forum for Theological Exploration. And they funded me to interview people of faith who are engaged in the ministry of justice, whether that be eco-justice, gender, reproductive, racial, class, immigrant, you name it. I was interested in how people of faith choose to live out their call to justice. So today I'm going to talk about why I left Seattle, what I sought on this pilgrimage, where I actually went, what I saw and experienced, who I had the pleasure of meeting, and some takeaways, what I learned from this time. Why I left, so we'll start here. This is a great Mary Oliver poem called The Journey, and the first line is, "One day you finally knew what you had to do and began." So this thing was happening to me in Seattle. I lived there for 2.5 years and worked in nonprofits doing homeless advocacy. And pretty much as soon as I moved to Seattle after college in Georgia, I realized that it was going to be a temporary home to me. For whatever reason, the city just didn't ignite me in a way where I saw myself living there long term. And in year 2 of my living there, I was working in a job that wasn't really feeding my soul. I was living in a house with roommates that didn't share the same desire for an intentional living space with me. And I was in a romantic relationship where I was realizing, I don't think I'm in love with this person. So there were some moments of discontentment during my time in Seattle that culminated into me feeling what I call an itchiness. And I call it an itchiness because I think in the moments in my life where I feel like I'm not on my path or fulfilling my life's purpose, I start to get really itchy. Like something's up and this just isn't right. And I started whining and complaining about this itchiness to my friends and family. Yeah, I don't really like Seattle. Yeah, my job, it's hard to wake up and go to. Yeah, I'm living in this house, but it's not great. From the first month of this itchiness to month 9, when I finally decided to go, several things happened that really pushed me out the door. So this is how I finally left. The first thing that happened is on my 23rd birthday, the movie Wild came out in theaters, and I went to go see it by myself. And I remember the movie ending and the credits rolling, and I had tears in my eyes, and I was like, I have to go, whatever, which I clearly did not do. Stayed in a car for a lot of my trip. But this journey that Cheryl Strayed took as a young 20-something really inspired me to think about what I was doing with my life, how short life really is, and what I would rather be doing instead. Then my mom came out to Seattle, and she bought me this book. It's called The Crossroads of Should and Must. Find and Follow Your Passion. And this is a great book. Mara just read it, so you should ask her what she thinks. But this is an author who had a fantastic job and lifestyle in San Francisco, but continued to have this dream where she was in a studio. And so she finally followed this dream and rented a studio space and began painting, and realized that her life, albeit really good, was sort of in the should category. She should have this great high-paying job. She should be living in a high-end apartment in the Bay Area. And what the studio and the painting helped her realize is that it's important to choose must. And so the painting in the studio was her must. And I read this book and thought, oh, I'm totally in the should, and I really want to choose must. But there are all kinds of excuses for not choosing must. And so I stayed in the itchiness for a while longer. But then I went home to Nashville. This is a picture of my three oldest friends. They've known me since I was four. And during this meal, they kind of heard what was going on in my life and reflected back to me that I was not in my wheelhouse fulfilling my calling. And I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but when people that I love tell me something I cannot see myself, somehow I see it with new eyes, and I'm willing to listen in a new way. So I went back to Seattle after that and went to breakfast with my friend Caroline, who a lot of you got to meet last week. She was up here teaching yoga. And I said, oh, I really want to leave, but I can't because I've got to do this young adult thing and stay here and do the grind. And she looked at me and was like, just go. Just go. Just write down what you would do if you could go and go. So that day, I wrote down what I would do if I left, which we'll get to. And I looked up grants for young people who don't have a clue. Which you can Google, by the way. It's a really interesting Google search. And I found this grant for young adults who are interested in ministry, but need to do some kind of project or shadow a pastor or an author or go out on their own in order to figure out if that really is their calling. And then this picture represents the Holy Spirit. I think there was certainly meaning in the waiting in the 9 months of itchy, but then to finally leave, I think that was in a lot of ways the Spirit moving and grooving and kicking me out of the door. Any questions so far? Great. So then I had to figure out what I would do if I left. And here is what I sought. I really wanted to reconnect with my family history. I think as white people, we so often lose our sense of identity around culture and ethnicity. And it was important for me to go back and go to the places where my family immigrated to from Ireland and meet relatives I had never met before and get kind of a deeper sense of who I am and where I come from. I also really wanted to figure out what the heck I was going to do with my life. I have a lot of interests, but I didn't really know where they all fit. What does it mean that I like the outdoors and Jesus and feminism and young people? What does that mean for my life? Self-discovery, classic. Self-discovery, gotta do it, gotta have it. So that's something I was seeking. And then this question of a landscape of home. Seattle did not feel like home to me, and I was curious to explore the U.S. and see where my soul really felt like it was at rest and at ease. And then I was really inspired by the term pilgrim, which is a person who seeks sacred spaces or goes on a religious journey. And so that was certainly part of my journey. This is actually a picture from Quinn Road in Eureka, California, which is where the Quinns set up Quinn Ranch in the 1800s. And we'll get there. And so this is what I wrote in my journal the day before I left. I want to be enriched and inspired, to be emptied out and filled up, to to witness God's work in the nooks and crannies, to see God in all things, to be in reverence of movement alone, to find solace in solitude, to ask thoughtfully and listen deeply. This is what I must do. And this is that fateful day with Caroline. I started coming up with a list of, if I quit my job on September 31st, which I did, here's what I wanted to do. And you can see there's hole in it right there. And clearly I've still got some things left on it. So if anybody wants to go to Mount St. Helens here, just come
on. I'd like to know how you quit on September 31st. It's real. There is no September 31st.
Is there not now?
No. Sorry, I just...
30 days in September, April, June, April. Wow! I'm still working there! As you can see, I'm a women's studies major, not a math major. Thank you, John.
Yes.
Price for you being a very perceptive audience member. Yes, so I quit my job on September 30th. There. And began. Okay, so this is one last thing before we get into the actual Pilgrim March. These are questions that I wrote in my grant that I wanted to ask the people I was interviewing. And I won't read them all, but you kind of get the feel for where I was going. I was really trying to figure out, how the heck do people fall in love with their work, stay in love with their work, be people of faith working for social justice, who live open-heartedly and don't get burnt out and have sustainable, full lives. Because working with the homeless population, I was just done. Done at 24. So as you can see, graphic design is my strong suit. I made this in Paint. It's a great, I can show anybody how to use Paint after this if you need a tutorial. So this is where I went on the Pilgrim March. I started way up top, outside of Seattle in the Satan Wilderness, made my way down the California coast, across to Nashville. So that was month one. Month two, I did a little North Carolina, Georgia, Alabama loop. Month three, I did an Alabama, Mississippi, New Orleans loop. And then month four, I started going up the East Coast, making my way back to Holden. The stars represent people I interviewed or really big epiphanies I had. And Paint has this great shape icon where you can actually like make a 6-point star without having to do what I did with the black star at the top where I was trying to draw it. So that's a detailed, extensive look at the Pilgrim March geography. So now we'll get into what I saw. And I broke this up into four parts because month one was a lot of me visiting beautiful, awe-inducing outdoor places. Month two was really about me coming home to myself, to my Southern identity, to my calling, to communities that I hadn't seen in a while. Month three was being called. And that was a lot of visiting civil rights museums, social justice sites, and feeling like God was really stirring something in me. And then month four was coming back toward the West and sharing this experience as I was traveling back with friends and strangers as I traveled. So I'm just gonna show you some pictures. Again, this is just a snapshot, but this is a little look at month one. The first 4 days of the Pilgrim March, I was in the Pisatan Wilderness, not far from Holden. This is at Bremel Lake at sunrise, or sunset? Yeah, I think it was sunrise. Beautiful, beautiful place. And I chose to backpack the first couple days to kind of clear my head of city life and prepare for the four-month journey ahead. Then I went down to Oregon, and I actually went to a place called Brighton Bush Hot Springs and Retreat Center and attended an Enneagram 3-day workshop there, which was super cool. And my friend Katie went with me, and we went to this place called Blue Lake, which is just a really, really blue lake. It's got a great name. And there's a river that kind of comes out of it, and I said, "What's the river telling you?" And she said, "Slow down." And she said, "What's the river telling you?" And I said, Shut up. So, lots of good time with nature. This is me being a tree hugger in Northern California. I had hug a redwood on my bucket list. This is driving down the California coast. Big stretches of nothing. As I left California and started making my way back to the South, there was just a lot of expansive space, which actually makes for really good thinking time. The Grand Canyon, this is the Grand Canyon right as the sun has set. And this is the Grand Canyon at sunset, where the sun just looks like it's slipping off of the earth. It's really, really something. So that was the first part. Again, just trying to get outside after being in an office for 2 years and feel connected to something bigger in the natural world. Part two was coming home. And this is a picture of the Blue Ridge Mountains. So here's day 29. This is the Blue Ridge Parkway in North Carolina. And as soon as I crossed into the state, as Ben can attest to, I felt a really special feeling. It's just a gorgeous state with incredible landscape. And I drove this parkway a lot in college. And as soon as I got back on it, I felt this sense of calm that I really was not feeling in the Pacific Northwest. Despite how beautiful it is out here, there's just something about this landscape that spoke to me. And a year before the Pilgrim March, my mom had planned a women's retreat for me and my sisters and my sisters-in-law. So this was right outside of Asheville. I was having a really good hair day. And this was really neat because it had been, as you can tell, a month into the trip. And this is my sister Katie, who's a therapist, and my sister-in-law Tolu, who's a pastor. So they were like, what are you feeling? What are you thinking? What's going on? And I'm just like trying to take in their wisdom in my journal and brush my hair perhaps later. But again, coming home to this community of women that has watched me grow. And I put this picture in here because I can't really explain why, but something about this sunset, these trees, it just reminds me so much of growing up in the South. And there's something about landscapes, outer landscapes, that I think really call to our inner landscape. And I, again, started to feel like I was home and needed to come back to the South as much as I've been fighting that over the years. And then this part of the Pilgrim March, I actually went back to all of the camps that I've worked at. There were no campers there, which was kind of sad. Like, this is a really cool slide. It's like, woo! And to see no campers on the slide was kind of weird. But this is a camp in Black Mountain. And I emailed all of my camp friends a couple months before I left and said, would you come back to camp for this weekend? And some of them said yes. So coming home to camp friends, coming home to communities that I hadn't gotten to see in years and years. And then I stopped in Durham, actually, to see a buddy who goes to Duke Divinity School and really did not have this on my radar at all. And I walked into the campus and felt, as Danielle calls it, the tingle, that I was supposed to be here, and this is where I would be going to school, which I tried to fight, as I often do when the spirit is moving and grooving, but that's where I'm going in August. And this is in the Duke Chapel. I call this Women on Fire, which I really identify with. So this was coming home in a lot of ways to my future and my calling. I got to see my brother, who is just as lanky as I am. Wanted you to have proof of that. And went back to my college town, went back to the diner where I used to work. They have the best feta dip and french fries ever. And saw my old boss, went back to my sorority house. I was really just hitting up Nostalgia Avenue during this part of the Pilgrim March. Went to a Frisbee tournament with my old high school Frisbee team. teammates on the end there, and then my new college teammates, and then some Seattle teammates. And then rented a house over Thanksgiving with college buddies to reconnect with them. And did a lot of babysitting, which made me realize I'm not supposed to be a mom yet at all. But again, there was just these like moments during the journey, and one of them was my sister-in-law called me and said, can you babysit these two kids for 2 days by yourself? And I was like, but it was part of the Pilgrim March. It totally had a lesson there. Mainly that sleep is something that I really cherish now in my life. But yeah, all of it was part of the homecoming for me. Any questions about chunk number two? Great. So part three, or month three, was being called. And I spent the third month of this journey, namely in Alabama and New Orleans and Mississippi, which are really, really interesting places to visit. And so this part of the trip, I visited a lot of civil rights museums, like I was saying, drove the Freedom Trail, lots of different things like that. So this is the 16th Street Baptist Church where four young black girls were bombed and killed in the 60s during the Civil Rights Movement. And this is actually across the street from the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute. A really cool part of this journey is that I would go to these museums during the day by myself, during the off season usually. And so I walked through a lot of museums alone without really seeing anybody else other than the people that worked there. And in some ways that was really neat because I could kind of take it all in. And this museum in particular is incredibly powerful because it links all of the people of faith to the civil rights movement and shows how they really felt called, both white and black folks, to be on the front lines of this movement for racial justice and healing. This is the church where Martin Luther King Jr. preached for several years. And this was at the Rosa Parks Center. So as the Black Lives Matter movement was kind of heating up last year, they were doing a lot of exhibits in these civil rights museums to showcase that. And I just love this image and the kids in the picture advocating for themselves. We are praying with our feet. I thought that was really powerful. This is the Edmund Pettus Bridge. If you've seen the movie Selma, you'll recognize this. This is me standing under the bridge. But this is where Martin Luther King Jr. and several hundreds of people from all over the country came to walk from Selma to Montgomery to stand up for the dignity and respect of black folks, of all folks. Thank you.
It's right there, but I don't know how
to... Should I scoot this closer? Thank you so much, Odie. Here's another picture of the bridge. So I walked across this bridge one day, and actually Edmund Pettus was in the KKK, and the bridge was named after him, which is really ironic. There are a lot of petitions to change the name. But as I was walking, I heard God's voice saying, don't just walk this bridge, be a bridge. And so again, it was this sense of, I can't just show up at these places and pay the ticket fee and look at what history has happened. I have to engage with it once this trip is over. So this is me, driving the Selma to Montgomery Trail. This is a great restaurant called Mama's. Amazing Southern food, just FYI. So that was part three, being called. And there was some time in New Orleans, which is a crazy city if you've been there. It's sort of like Holden in that it really shouldn't exist because of natural disasters. And yet it does, and so people are constantly reconciling with how are we still here and how do we hold both this kind of bohemian sense of spirit and also just the pain of Katrina and what's going on there.
Margie?
Yeah.
Are you able to describe what really happened on the bridge in more detail, other than that you were called to be a bridge?
Yes, you mean historically?
No, I mean, if it's too personal, don't. But don't just walk the bridge, be a bridge is a powerful statement. How did that emerge? What?
Yeah.
You said you heard the voice.
I heard the voice. Thunder down from the... No, I mean, for me, God is a still small voice, always. Sometimes God's shouting at me. But this day, as I got out of my car, there's a parking lot right before the bridge. And this bridge has become more and more well-known because it was the 50th anniversary of that famous march last year. And the movie Selma came out, which, again, is fantastic. We should watch it here. But I started walking it, and it's just a thin place. It's a thin place where me and God become less far away. And I don't think you can walk it without feeling a sense of responsibility, both personal and societal, to be an advocate for change, whatever that is for you. And for me, that's showed up in my life in a lot of ways as a racial justice advocate. Does that help you?
Yeah.
It was really just in the walking. Uh-huh. It was just in the walking that I felt it, heard it. Yeah. Going forth. So I stopped at home after part three to apply to seminary, which took longer than I thought. And then I got back in the car right at the new year to finish out the last month of my trip. And again, this last month was really about how do I share what's happened with my friends? Because for the first time in a couple years, I was on the right path and I knew it. And I really wanted to empower and embolden my other 20-something companions and compadres to be able to take that bold step as well and believe that you deserve to be in your wheelhouse, fulfilling your calling, doing your purpose every single day that you're alive. So again, a lot more standing in awe, but a lot of sharing as well. So this is the beginning of the drive, the Shenandoah Mountains in Virginia. And this drive, I decided to start shouting Mary Oliver poems out into the mountains. I think because I was going crazy from spending so much time by myself, but this is where that was happening. This is DC, this is the National Cathedral, an amazing, amazing space. Up to New York, to Boston, Vermont, which is just magical. Canada, made it. I wanted to pay a quarter to look into it, but I couldn't. The ice was covering me. Michigan. I ran up to a parking deck to see the sunset and the moon. If you can see it, it's just right there. It's really, really gorgeous. Madison. I love this picture. The lifeguard on duty. Clearly. No need, yeah. And then South Dakota, which, oh my gosh, if you haven't been to the Badlands. So, oh, by the way, this is my car. The first month of the trip, I took buses and got rides, and then I was able to pick up my high school car, which is a hand-me-down from one brother to the other brother to me, and has been well-loved, as you can see. And the car's name is Frosty, so this is me and Frosty in the Badlands. And I was going to do a hike there, but I saw this and I was like, I don't even have a whistle. I'm not about to go in there.
They hibernate.
They hibernate?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Most of the time.
Wish I'd known that 6 months ago. This is just another picture of the Badlands. It's an otherworldly, haunting, spooky, crazy place. And then I drove through Montana, Idaho, back to Seattle, and finished the trip on February 8th, and then came up to Holden on February 15th. This is a quick shout out to the public art on my journey. There is just some incredible, incredible public art happening in the country, and I don't claim myself to be an artist and don't really think I had appreciated art as a social message until I was driving around seeing so much of it. So I just have a couple pictures. This is one from Oakland. This is in Salinas, California, just to remind you. This is outside of the Steinbeck Museum. If you're a Steinbeck nerd like me, I was like, I love the Steinbeck Museum. And I just love this mural. This is in Montgomery, the Edmund Pettus Bridge, and then they've got protesters and the Civil Rights Memorial mural. That's right at the foot of the Edmund Pettus Bridge. This was in New York City. I just walked by it, and it was the exact thing I needed to read that day. And whoever stenciled that there, I mean, it's just one brick in a city, but it was powerful. This is, again, in New York City. All of our problems stem from our acceptance of this filthy, rotten system. Dorothy Day and Sojourner Truth, two great women. This was in a pastry shop in Harlem. Expect a miracle today. This is a quilt. So this was stitched by youth in New Orleans. Just an incredible piece of art. And I thought Lori would like this. Somebody in Boston knitted all of these like tree coverings. And then
it's called bombing.
Bombing?
Bombing, big bombing.
It made my day. I was sitting in a park and all these trees had little jackets. This was in someone's kitchen. I just liked it.
Margie?
Yeah.
Doesn't Occidental Park have those sweaters on the trees anymore?
Occidental?
All of
them. Oh,
in Seattle and Pioneer Square?
I don't know. Does it?
Yeah.
Should have gotten down there.
Yeah.
This was in Chicago. Just chalk. Knowledge not shared remains unknown. And again, in Chicago, someone just forgive. So that's kind of a overview of the journey. Any questions so far? Peter!
Yeah, I should have asked this when you started. At the beginning of month four, you had made the comment that you knew you were on the right path.
Yeah.
But you didn't know how to tell your friends.
Yeah.
Okay, so I have two questions.
Okay.
So once again, feel free to go on to as much or as little detail as you want.
Yeah.
But first two is, how did you know? Like, what changed that you knew I'm on the right path? I know this is my calling. This is what I know God wants me to do.
Yeah.
And then second, how did you tell your friends? What did you do? Or what are you? What process are you in talking to your friends? I should say that.
Yeah. Okay. That's a great question. And it's one I'll get into in the what I learned section.
Sure.
But the long and short of it is.
Which one?
Okay, so question one, part A. How did I know I was on the right path?
Yes.
Because everywhere I went, something crazy happened that just showed me how held I was. And I'm always held. I really believe that. But I had. People would say, well, how do you feel? And I would just say, I feel help. I can't explain it, but something is really holding me in this journey. And just absolutely crazy, cannot be a coincidence, things continue to happen as I traveled. Like the universe was just like, here you go, and then come here, and then come here. Which isn't to say that painful and bad things did not happen, but even when they did, I knew instinctually is what I meant to do right now. Part two, how do I tell my friends? I'm still trying to figure that out because it's almost like falling in love, where you're like, like, whoa, calm down there. But just by sharing what I just shared about the itchiness I felt in Seattle, and then the pain of letting go, and then the beauty of when I let go, actually realizing I'm on it again. Countless friends began to change their lives too. which I don't contribute to me as much as something working through me to reach them. So many of my friends have quit their jobs now or moved or broken up with people that were potentially not for them and are doing their own pilgrimage, which sometimes doesn't even mean leaving their city. But that is, yeah, such an amazing impact of the trip. So I haven't even talked about the grant part, which is an important part. But I want to tell you about four people I met who really shifted the way that I think about justice work and faith work. So this is this woman, Patty, in Durham, who I was connected with through a friend. She's a white anti-racist organizer, and she's also a yoga teacher. And she runs a studio called Yoga for Misfits and Queers. And it's a yoga studio for people who have physical disabilities, queer people, people who don't identify within the gender binary, people bigger than a size zero, people of color, all kinds of folks. And her yoga spaces are particularly for these people who might walk into a yoga studio at a gym and see a bunch of like skinny white women and be afraid to take up space in that space. So she felt called to start her own yoga studio, which in a lot of ways is her church. And so I asked her about this, and she said, well, I started going to yoga, and I'm a really big woman, and I didn't feel comfortable there. She said, if we all don't get to access it, it's not collective liberation. It's not for everyone, which really stuck out to me. And then I said, how do you not get burnt out doing all of the justice work you do in North Carolina? She said, I make mistakes, and then I practice compassion for myself, which was hitting me hard. And then I said, okay, Patty, what would you tell yourself at 25? And she said, no one is more equipped to be your best friend or worst enemy than you. So be your friend. This man is just so fantastic and hilarious. His name is Johnny Ray, and he is a retired minister and farmer in Cedar Bluff, Mississippi. And he runs a sustainable beef and vegetable farm in this tiny little rural town in Mississippi. And I was told by several people, you have to go meet Johnny Ray. You have to go meet Johnny Ray. And Johnny Ray put me right to work. This is a cow. Yeah, it is a cow. This is me on a... and he was the executive director of something in my denomination called Week of Compassion, which does a lot of global advocacy. And he was the director for 17 years and then quit to start this farm. And I said, Johnny, how many people purchase this sustainable, grass-fed, compost-friendly beef and veggies that you produce here? He said, I don't know, about 50. And I was like, that's it? You could go big with this. Like, this man was making his own kombucha in the back of his yard, but, you know, was saying it with a southern accent, which is crazy. And he said, well, I don't do it for people. I do it to be a witness to it. And I was like, oh, crap. That's a really good lesson for me, because what would I do if no one even looked or noticed? Would I still be doing the work I'm doing now? And for Johnny, I mean, he's going pretty much unnoticed and continues to be a witness to the work he really believes in. There was a guy in Birmingham, he calls himself a pastor of justice, and he runs this urban ministries. He's a white dude that was placed in a predominantly black neighborhood and told to start a church there that was cross-racial, cultural, cross-class. His name is Archie, and he's a really shy, but like powerful dude, kind of like Kent. He's got some Kent vibes going on. And I said, do you ever want to leave Alabama because you're in this kind of podunk area? And he said, if everybody who cares about justice leaves Alabama, how will Alabama change? And that was a moment when I felt like God was saying, you can't leave the South, because if you do, who's going to stay, you know? And then he said this to me. He said, I go through life feeling like I'm utterly and completely failing, and like I'm changing the world. I And so the prayer that he says every morning to himself is, God, help me be no more or no less than I am, which I thought was really interesting. And then this was just, he does faith. Faith is involved in his justice work because it's the language through which he understands himself in the world. He just put it really nicely. I just liked that quote. And then lastly is a man named Hector Black, who is a gay peace activist in Cookeville, Tennessee. When I drove to his house, it was 6 in the morning, and there were Trump signs lining driveways all around his. And then I got to his house, and there were no Trump signs. And I was like, what's going on here? And Hector Black is known. He's actually been interviewed on NPR several times because of this really powerful thing he did about 20 years ago. He adopted a daughter when he was living in Atlanta, Georgia with his wife at the time, who was a black school teacher and just had kind of absent parents. And so he legally adopted her, and about 11 years later into her time with their family, she was coming home from work one day, came into her house, and there was a burglar there. And the burglar pointed the gun at her, and she said, please, just don't shoot me, take what you want. And he said, I'm gonna rape you. And she said, please, please leave. And this man was just really, really strung out on drugs and ended up raping and killing her that day. Mm-hmm. And Hector went to court along with her biological brothers and sisters and his family to read a statement. And he, instead of reading a statement condemning the man who had done this, he forgave him. He said, I was being nudged and nudged to do something that I did not want to do. But he looked the man in the eyes and said, you are a child of God, and I forgive you for what you've done. And he continued to write this man in jail, and then he started to visit him. It's a really powerful story, and he still, to this day, visits this man in jail who has no family and obviously really regrets what he'd done. The last thing I asked him before I left his house was, what did it feel like when you actually forgave him? What does that feel like? And he said, it wasn't like a lightning bolt. It was quiet.
I was just going to say, if anybody wants to hear that story, it's on The Moth. And so you can just look up, search Hector Black, and you can hear the whole story. It's really powerful.
Yeah, thank you. Absolutely. So, last chunk, and then we'll take some questions. What I learned, lots of things. Know where you come from. So this is a picture from Quinn Ranch in Eureka, California, where the Quinns first made their home in the United States. And when I decided to take the time to reconnect with my roots, I found out that I come from a long generation of healers, doctors mostly. And so that part of me, that kind of pastoral part of me, started to make more sense because of my lineage and where I come from. And it became a really special thing for me. Go back to the source of fear. So, it was really, really hard for me to go back to college and camp and a couple places in the South because they were such moments of joy in my life, kind of frozen in time. This is the entrance to the girls' camp I worked at, Green Cove. But in returning to these places that I've been afraid to see again, I was in some ways able to say thank you for what you taught me, what I learned at camp or at college or at this restaurant, and be able to look into the faces of people that are still there, some of them, and be grateful for that. So that was actually really important for me. People want to help. I stayed with so many strangers. This is a UCC minister in Ashland, Oregon, and her daughter. I tried to do Craigslist rideshare, and the guy was really creepy. Long story there, but I ended up not getting in the car with them. So they took me in for three more nights, and fed me, gave me like $20, bunches of stuff. And that continued to happen again and again, where when I would ask for help, people were like, duh, which is kind of great. Start local, stay local. This was a picture of composted SHIT at Johnny Ray's farm. That's literally, it's a literal steaming pile of shit, which is kind of cool. But I think what was happening to me in Seattle was I was feeling like I had to save the world and to get involved in this after work and do this and volunteer at this place. And he taught me so much about going back to your context and starting small and believing that this one man at this one farm is enough, that I'm enough in the simple and small ways that I do. Here it is, Peter, when you're on the right path, the universe provides. And this, I really, really cannot stress this one enough. I could talk forever about this, but so many things happened that just cannot be coincidence. This is a picture of snow in the Pusaten. When I was backpacking, it started to rain really hard, which was not the forecast, and I was incredibly cold and wet, and about 30 miles from my car, unable to make it back before dark. And my hands were shaking and so numb, I was really nervous I wasn't gonna be able to set up my tent. And I kept walking, and I came to a sign, and I looked up, and there was a cabin. And it was a backcountry skier's cabin, and it was made by Troop 92 or something. So this is a picture of me standing on the cabin. So I slept in the cabin that night, and I woke up the next morning and it had snowed. This other time in Ashland, Oregon, I was walking around and I bought a book of Mary Oliver poetry that day, and somebody asked me what book I would give to everybody in the world, and I said the Book of Job. And then I found this poem in a book. The poem's called God Says Yes to Me. And the next day I went to a church in Ashland, and it was Creativity Sunday. So congregants were reciting works of poetry or art, and the first congregant stood up and read a Mary Oliver poem, and the second congregant stood up and read from the Book of Job, and the third congregant stood up and read God Says Yes to Me, this poem. And I was like, what is happening? And the fourth congregant got up and recited a poem called The Way It Is by William Stafford. It's a short poem, and it goes, there's a thread you follow. It goes among things that change, but it doesn't change. People wonder about what you are pursuing. You try to explain about the thread, but it's hard for others to see. While you hold it, you can't get lost. Tragedies happen, people suffer and die and get old. You never let go of the thread. And that poem really resonated with what I was doing, and clearly by the first three things happening, I was like really paying attention. So, I have 1,000 more. There was a restaurant in DC, I was reading a book by Zora Neale Hurston called Their Eyes Were Watching God. Thank you. And I walked into a restaurant and they were like, oh, this is Zora Neale Hurston's restaurant. This is, we built this in honor of her. I said, great, I'm reading a book by her. And I said, what's for dessert? And they said, well, it's her birthday today, so apple pie. And I was like, what is happening? There were just these things. And I underlined a sentence in that book that says, there are years that ask questions and years that answer. And later, when I stayed with a woman in Vermont, she had a board above her desk, and on a post-it, it said, there are years that ask questions and years that answer. So again, clearly I could go on forever about that. Listening to my gut, I started to trust my instincts a lot more as I was traveling and traveling alone. And this is the same picture from Duke, just listening to the tingle and really believing that I'm tingling for a reason, good and bad. Steinbeck has a great quote. He says, we learn after years and years that we do not take a trip takes us. This is day 53. I had spilled coffee everywhere, and I was like, this is actually in my kitchen. This is actually a title that I painted when I was 5 of a duck. But there was a lot of hard stuff that happened on the trip. I ran out of money. I got lost a lot. I had a friend pass away. I got in some fights with mom and dad. But ultimately I felt like it was all happening for me. It was all part of the trip. It was all part of the pilgrim march. So the trip really took me in a lot of ways. This is one of the last ones. Sacred places are everywhere. So obviously standing at the Grand Canyon or the Badlands or Niagara Falls, those are really special sacred places. But I also felt that thin place feeling in a lot of ordinary, non-majestic places as well. So this is one of them. This is a Vaporeum in Boston. Has anybody been to this? Oh my gosh, okay, so it's in the Christian Science Center. And you're not allowed to take pictures when you're in it, so I had to pull this from Google. But I was the only one on the tour that day. No surprises there. And I walked into this Vaporeum about this far in with the tour guide. And he was this kind of nerdy guy in his 30s. And the Vaporeum goes all the way under and all the way up, so you're kind of looking down at the South Pole, and then looking up at the North Pole, is that right?
Yep.
Thank you. Geography, again, not a strong suit. And it was an incredibly sacred space. And so I asked the guy if I could sing a verse of Amazing Grace, and this kind of nerdy, awkward guy was like, yeah. And it's just me and him in there. starting to sing, and he's like, clearly can't go anywhere, and like, wants to let me do my thing. And as I finished, he was like, thank you for that. I was like, you're welcome. And I'll never see that guy again, but it was just one of those moments where I was like, this is really, really cool. This is really sacred. I don't know if this is going to work, but we'll just see. Build pockets of stillness in your life. So, as you can imagine, there was a lot of me driving alone. This is me driving through the Natchez Trace Parkway in Mississippi. I just picked this video because it shows you that nothing's going on. There are no other cars. I'm just driving. But on this day in particular, I decided to pray for every person in my family and not just say, oh, you know, thanks for Katie, she's great, like I usually do, but really pray for them. And I don't do that in my regular life because I like to stay really, really busy and I like to do and go. And the trip forced me to spend hours in a car with myself and my thoughts and to do some things that I don't make time for in my regular life. Oh, no? And this is the last one. You always have you. There were so many places that I wish I could have seen with someone else. I would turn and say, and then no one would be there. This was in Montana. And I really learned how to be my own friend. I started to talk to myself a lot out loud, which was great. And begin really looking forward to and enjoying the time by myself, with myself, which as an extrovert, is hard for me. So in a lot of ways, the loneliness actually created space for me to figure out how to spend time, not just by myself, but with myself. And this is the last slide. This is the end of a Mary Oliver poem. Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? That's all she wrote. Are there any questions?
Do you have a preset, a schedule that you're going to meet this person here and this person there, and or did it kind of flow?
I gave people a range. So what I did was I called and asked friends and family to just tell me where they would go or who they would meet if they could do a pilgrim march, and I took all the notes back here, and then I just emailed these people and said, I'll be there at some point, and I'll call or email you a week before to let you know. Some of them insisted that I stayed with them, and some of them only had time for coffee, and so it just kind of flowed. Yeah. Yeah.
So how much was your grant for, and how is it that you ran out of money? Why didn't you plan out?
Plan better. My mom wonders the same thing. So I will be completely transparent with you. I had saved up $1,500 from working in homeless advocacy, which is quite a lot if you're working in homeless advocacy. And the grant was only $1,500. So I left Seattle with $3,000, which made it to Chicago. And then the last 2 weeks of the trip were funded by Robin K. Quinn, but have to be paid back by September 1st. So we're working on it. We have fees going. yeah, I mean, I stretched that $3,000 hard. I was very forthcoming about, can I stay with you? Can I eat a meal with you? And which is really un-Southern of me. Southerners try to be really polite and hospitable, but I knew I had to do this journey at this time, and I knew that if I let money stop me, it just wasn't gonna happen, so.
Well, no, you did really good if you made it to the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, yeah. My mom would argue otherwise, but yeah.
What did you have to do for the grant? Like, do you have to present all over the place, or?
No, this is the crazy thing. They want me to send them a 3-page paper by September 1st, which is actually a lot harder than if it was like a 50-page paper, yeah. Right? Yeah. And I think that I'll send them this, because I would really love for them to see how the trip transpired, and I don't think they know still what it's meant to me. Yeah.
So the questions that you wrote down at the beginning that you wanted to ask people as you were going on, have you taken time to ask yourself those questions as well?
Great question, Miranda. You should consider seminary. yes. And now I have answers to them. And I can honestly say that I did not have answers to them in Seattle, which is part of how I know I'm on the right path is I know what my deep gladness is. I know what makes my heart sing. I know what ministry is for me. I know what my calling is, but I had to leave in order to, find answers. Maybe. So cheesy.
But maybe when you framed those questions, those were the questions you needed to have answered for yourself, more so than maybe the individuals that you had a chance to talk to.
Yeah. It's 5, so we can stop there. I have pieces of paper and pencils here. Mart hears me say this a lot, but now that this has happened, I'm really careful about what I write down and wish for, because I really think once it's said to the air, once it's written, there's a really good chance it's gonna happen to you in your life. It's just crazy. So this is an opportunity if you'd like to just make a list for yourself. It doesn't have to be a bucket list or a list of a pilgrimage per se, but it's wild what happens if you conspire